and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
The truth is that this budget is fiscally responsible.
It's just smoke and mirrors.
With a looming deadline, does Chicago have a deal on the budget? Heather Sharone joins us live from City Hall with the latest.
These products have an intoxicating effect, often to dangerous levels.
A push to regulate hemp products in Illinois. We hear from backers of a proposed bill and critics.
There are not many grocery stores that are within walking distance of our neighborhoods.
And a look at Chicago food insecurity this holiday season. And now to tonight's top story. For Mayor Brandon Johnson and the Chicago City Council, the fourth time was the charm. Chicago has a spending plan for 2025 after a close vote by alder people that ended months of tense negotiations and an afternoon of charged debate.
My colleagues have stood up saying no to property tax. And we, with the support of everybody in this room, sent a message 50-0 that we did not want property tax. Since then, we miraculously just, voila, went to 150. And you all rejected the 150. We went to 68. Now, miraculously, voila again, we go to zero. However, in order to get to zero, we are fining and feeing the people of the city of Chicago to death.
I do think, in spite of my frustrations and challenges, that democracy is represented in the budget that is in front of us today. Do I think it is a complete and perfect reflection of my values, my community values? No. But it is a budget that moves us forward in ways that I think are responsible? Yes.
Our Heather Sharone joins us now with the latest. Heather, the main sticking point, which was the proposed property tax hike that we just heard quite a bit about, was completely removed less than 24 hours ago. How did the city council make up the difference?
Well, the mayor went back to the drawing board and found a combination of cuts and quote-unquote operational efficiencies to bridge that last gap, and that was the crucial piece that had been missing up until this point. The city council voted 27-23, one of the closest budget votes in Chicago history, to pass the spending plan, averting a government shutdown that would have happened on December 31st, and ensuring that 30,000 city workers will still get paid and that Chicagoans will continue to rely on the city services that they need. But they did it without making significant or structural changes to the way the city's finances operate. And in fact, the only way the city was able to avoid a property tax increase was to put off paying nearly $40 million in debt that former Mayor Richard M. Daley incurred when he bought the former Michael Reese Hospital site. City officials will have to figure out how to foot that bill next year.
Okay. But this budget does include a hike in taxes. Heather, what does this mean for Chicagoans?
So in all, Chicagoans will pay $161.5 million more in taxes. The bulk of that will be paid by companies that lease digital goods, and that will hit large corporations hardest. But Chicagoans who sign up for streaming services and other digital subscriptions will also pay a little bit more to the city to help bridge this budget gap. And that was really sort of the only way that this budget can work. The city is finding its finances pinched by massive pension debt, a high level of debt, and escalating personnel costs.
Heather, several of the mayor's allies, though, they said they did vote for the mayor's budget, but reluctantly. Why was that?
Well, they felt that Mayor Brandon Johnson mismanaged these budget negotiations from stop to finish, and the two co-chairs of the Progressive Caucus let the mayor know that they are deeply disappointed in how he has handled this. They said that his management has left the city council badly fractured and made it harder for Chicagoans to trust that their government can operate in their best interests. There is no doubt that after these last couple of months, the mayor has a significant amount of fence mending and bridge building to do with those who have been his closest allies on the city council.
And to that point, many older people have said that this is one of the most difficult budget seasons that they have ever had to experience. And of course, Chicago's financial woes are not over after this. What happens next?
Well, everybody here at City Hall will be holding their breath to see whether Wall Street ratings agencies downgrade the city's credit rating. They had been hoping that the city would raise property taxes, which will ensure a steady stream of income for many years to come. That did not happen. And they will also be waiting to see whether all of this budget-related chaos will ensure that ratings downgrade. If it does, it will make it much, much more expensive for the city to borrow the money that it needs to operate on a daily basis.
Okay. Heather Sharone, of course, we'll check back in with you later in the program. Thank you. Up next, a growing debate over new regulations on the hemp industry in Illinois. We'll hear from two different sides right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Growers are pushing back on a state bill that would put new regulations on the industry. Backers of the measure, including Governor J.B. Pritzker, say tighter regulations would protect children in Illinois. But critics say the rules threaten to put them out of business. Joining us with more are, we've got Tiffany Chappelle Ingram, Executive Director of the Cannabis Business Association of Illinois, Illinois State Representative LaShawn Ford, and joining us via Zoom, Justin Ward, president of the Illinois Healthy Alternatives Association. We were hoping to have Illinois Senate Majority Leader, State Senator Kimberly Lightford, join us for this conversation as well. She might call in later. Stay tuned, everybody. Thanks to the three of you for joining us. Justin Ward, let's start with you, please. Explain the difference between hemp and cannabis.
So hemp was defined in the 2018 Federal Farm Bill as any plant derivative isomer salt from the cannabis plant that tests below 0.3% Delta 9 THC. And that is the distinction between what we call marijuana or high THC cannabis and hemp.
Okay, and of course, we know that that hemp can also be used for CBD, which we know has grown in popularity. And then there's the intoxicating hemp, the stuff that we're talking about called Delta 8. Tiffany, what is intoxicating hemp and why is it dangerous?
So intoxicating hemp is actually, it could be many different things, right? It's anything that's above the line of the 0.3 on a dry weight basis of Delta 9. And so what happens is that you have many actors that are creating sort of synthetic derivatives that make it more intoxicating. So they do certain things to change the molecular structure to make it more intoxicating so people will purchase it.
Okay. And what are the concerns with being able to buy that? Where does one get this?
So one of the major concerns is that it's predominantly unregulated. And what do I mean by that is that there's no requirements for age gating, testing, labeling, or even potency. And so when you don't have those, or tracking and tracing, sort of the similar things that you have in the cannabis industry. And when you have an industry that's been allowed to sort of run unfettered, we've seen instances where, nationally, you have seen numbers of many children going to the hospital because they're getting a hold of these products because they don't have the necessary protections in place.
And we know that Senator Lightford has, she sponsored House Bill 4293. What do we know about that bill and what it would do?
That's correct. That bill passed overwhelmingly in the Senate. The bill essentially is the Hemp Consumer Products Act, in which what it does is that it creates a sort of registration for hemp products. So it's not banning hemp, it's creating a regulatory structure, you know, with de minimis sort of regulatory structures in place to regulate hemp, so we know who's selling it, where they're getting it, and that it's properly tested, right? But then there's another part of that legislation that deals with intoxicating products, and those products, you know, will take another path that's very similar to how cannabis is regulated. And then the third thing that it does is that it completely removes the ability to create synthetic products, which we think are problematic.
Representative Ford, how would this legislation impact businesses that sell hemp products?
Well, Brandon, I would tell you that I agree with everything that Tiffany and the governor says about regulation. And so my thought is that we protect an industry that's already in existence, but regulate it and tax it and make sure that it's safe. It would definitely have a goal of limiting the age. Right now, people could purchase this under 21. We need to stop that now. We could do that today. We see people purchasing Delta products at these bad actors at gas stations and places like that. We need to shut them down today.
Justin, what are your concerns with this legislation?
Well, first, I'd like to echo some of the sentiment from the governor's office as well as the legislature and Rep. Ford that we as well in the hemp industry are concerned about children getting access to these products and are no way supportive of that. And we've been pushing for regulation for years. The problem is the technical flaws in some of the language in this legislation would create a ban that would ban even non-intoxicating full-spectrum CBD products because of the way that the bill is written. So things like CBD lotions and CBD oils would no longer be available the way the bill is currently written.
And same question to you, Justin. What's the impact that that legislation like this might have on businesses that sell the products?
It's devastating for businesses as well as consumers. So not only am I the president of the Illinois Healthy Alternatives Association, but I'm the co-founder and chief operating officer of Stony Branch Farms, which is our sixth generation family farm. And hemp was a lifeline for our farm to be able to get back involved in farming. We don't have the acreage to be involved in row crop farming in Illinois, and hemp allowed us the ability to get involved and farm our land again. This bill would put us out of business immediately. It would limit access to consumers who rely on these products. So it would be truly devastating to the hemp industry in Illinois. And the fact is, it doesn't truly close up the loophole of allowing these products to be able to get access to children to be able to get access to these products. These products would still be widely available online, could be shipped in from out of state, anywhere in the country, and Illinois would have no ability to regulate those products. So I think we really need sensible regulation here in the state that provides safe options for consumers who are getting true benefits from these products.
Tiffany, do you think that hemp products should only be sold at cannabis dispensaries?
So there's a distinction, right? So hemp products within themselves, CBD products, are not the challenge, right? I think there's been a misnomer of trying to ban hemp, and that's not the case. Like, to his point, like, some of these products are therapeutic, the CBD non-intoxicating products, and they're in the law. There is, you know, sort of provisions for that to account for this is a non-intoxicating product that doesn't require the sort of strict regulation that an intoxicating product would. Turning to the intoxicating product, that is a whole different issue. I mean, what we are seeing is that children are getting access to these products because there is no age gating. This unregulated industry has had sort of devastating effects on sort of the cannabis industry writ large. The state, you know, took a lot of investment to create a cannabis industry with social equity at its center. You have license holders that are, you know, social equity license holders that are sandwiched between Delta 8 sellers that are not subject to the requirements. Many dispensaries have to have like cameras and security and testing, and all that's very expensive. And plus we pay close to 40% in taxation. So, you know, those revenues from cannabis flow to all sorts of things that benefit the state. It flows to community programming, it flows to funding that goes to social equity programs and loans. And it's something that we're seeing a sort of, you know, erosion of that cannabis revenues that go to the state because we have an unfettered, unregulated market that is infringing on that. So,
Representative Ford, you've said that putting cannabis dispensaries in charge of hemp sales will put dispensaries basically in control of the market. What's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, there's a lawsuit right now in New Jersey, I believe, where they're being sued because they've done similar things that we're doing here in Illinois, and it gives a monopoly to the cannabis industry. We have to remember that Delta 9 is federally illegal. Delta 8 is legal.
Delta 9, of course, being THC.
THC cannabis.
Yes.
And we need to recognize that we did it for cannabis, regulated it, made it safe, taxed it, and made sure that people were able to get clean marijuana. We could do the same thing with Delta. We can't go back and say that we cleaned up the cannabis industry, but we're going to not clean up the Delta, and we're going to create an underground traditional market for Delta. That's wrong, and it's I guess I would call a new war on drugs.
Justin, what would you like lawmakers to know before moving forward if this should get called up?
Yeah, I would like legislators and the governor's office to know that we are more than happy to collaborate and educate and explain, you know, why 4293 would be so damaging to our industry and goes far beyond regulation, but is actually a ban. And that we want to see regulation pass, and we want to work with legislators to make that happen. So we will be reaching out, and we have been for several years, and we'll continue to do that until we can get good, sensible regulation for hemp passed here in Illinois that protects consumers, allows access to customers or you know, in need of these products, and allows businesses to continue to thrive and grow.
Tiffany, somebody mentioned New Jersey. What are other states doing to regulate hemp?
So I will say, majority of states that do have a cannabis program have instituted some type of, you know, regulation, whether it's a complete ban, some hybrid, or something or the other. And so I'd point to, you know, our neighbor in Missouri, whose governor had put in an executive order to actually have a ban, and that's not something what this legislation does. I'd like to applaud the governor for taking, you know, taking the step and taking action that he'd like to see this legislation that we believe is measured and had tons of stakeholder engagement, including from the hemp industry. And, you know, if you look at other states like California, also Governor Newsom has imposed an executive order basically saying, you know, hey, I want my health agency to get these products out of our market. So many, many states are taking action to regulate, ban, or some type of hybrid to make sure that they're protecting their citizens from these types of products.
Sounds like nobody's doing all the same thing.
Correct.
Just yet.
Correct.
Still
just
figuring
like cannabis
it out.
Regulation, it's a patchwork.
Still figuring that out. Okay, we'll have to leave it there. My thanks to Tiffany Chappelle Ingram, Justin Ward, and Representative LaShawn Ford. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, we check back in with Heather Sharone, who's reporting live from City Hall. Stay with us. And now we check back in with Heather Sharone, who's joining us from City Hall with Alderperson Jesse Fuentes of the 26th Ward. Heather.
Thanks, Brenda. Alderman Fuentes was one of the key swing votes, and she joins us now to talk about that. Alderperson, you said that had this vote taken place on Friday, you would have voted no, but today you voted yes. Why?
I think that this budget held the line for a lot of the things that I came into office championing, right? I represent a rapidly gentrifying community. My constituents are clear. They can't afford a property tax. This budget proposal had us at a $0 property tax. We've done important things in Humboldt Park, like house individuals from the Humboldt Park tent encampment, housing over 80 households in the last week and a half. This budget makes the investments in rapid rehousing and accelerated moving events. It prioritizes youth employment, peacekeeping, violence prevention, all the things that are important to me, my constituency, but more importantly, making sure that people can keep their homes in the 26th Ward.
You're a member of the Progressive Caucus. We heard from the two co-chairs today that they felt that Mayor Brandon Johnson, also a progressive, had badly mismanaged these negotiations. Do you agree with that?
I think that the process was difficult, right? That's something we can all articulate, something that we definitely all felt. I think when we learned of a $300 million property tax increase, we were worried. I do believe that there were moments in which real collaboration took place. This budget is a representation of that, bringing that property tax down to zero, seeing efficiencies, particularly in the mayor's office, making sure we hold the line on the pension obligation. This budget probably has more aldermanic input than we've seen historically.
One of the things that Alderman Maria Haddon, the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, said was that these negotiations have taken time away from older people preparing for President-elect Donald Trump to take office. He has said Chicago will be ground zero for his mass deportation office. You represent Humboldt Park. There are, I imagine, thousands of undocumented immigrants who are very scared tonight. Are you also frustrated that this took you away from that work?
I think that we're all frustrated with how much time some of the work here in City Council takes, right? Because we have an obligation to our constituents, but we also are all elected with the commitment that we're going to be very present in our ward, right? So I look forward to some of the adjustments that are going to be made through the budget management ordinance, really giving us the time to do both the City Council work and the ward work. I will say that on the Northwest side, our electeds have already brought together constituents from across the Northwest side in a post-election debrief in which we have already begun that work, right? We have
we'll
put
have
together
to leave it
committees.
There. Thank you so much. Back to you after a very long day at City Hall, Brandis.
I'm sure it has been a lot of work for the folks there, Heather, and Alderperson Jesse Fuentes included. Thanks to you both. Up next, battling food insecurity in Chicago. Stay with us. One in five Chicagoans is food insecure. That's in part because of a lack of grocery stores and affordable food options in their neighborhoods. In partnership with WTTW News, Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism students report on how some local organizations are putting produce and pantry staples on the shelves for those in need. Here's Mila Branson.
All right, you been here before?
Twice a week, Circle Urban Ministries in Austin opens its pantry doors to the public, serving all who come.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Coordinator Darielle Anderson says the nonprofit feeds about 1,000 people each month.
This is huge. It's an area that can easily be swept under the carpet, and it really impacts a large population of Chicago.
The ministry's pantry operates like a grocery store. Clients wheel carts through aisles and select items.
They're shopping for what they want. They have a choice of what they want to get. It allows us to be a little bit more intimate with the client.
Former client Frank Smith says he appreciates the pantry so much that he began volunteering as security.
What this place has done for me, it kept food in my family's mouth during those times I couldn't.
The nonprofit receives free food from the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Its pantry is one of several small pilots working with the organization.
There are not many grocery stores that are within walking distance of our neighborhoods. It really puts a hardship on our residents.
Another nonprofit, Dion Chicago Dream, hopes to remedy the food desert issue by delivering boxes of produce directly to clients. Dion Dawson founded the organization in 2020. And says it's grown to service more than 173 zip codes in Chicago.
If you say that your food is secure, you need the access, then we take you for your word.
The numbers demonstrate demand. The nonprofit currently delivers food packages to more than 4,000 households in Chicago each week, with a wait list of another 2,000 families.
We're not convinced that the need is going anywhere. How do we just, every day keep chipping away in a way where, you can see that tangible growth?
Dawson says his organization has received government grants, but it's mainly supported by donations from individuals. Dion's Chicago Dream purchases food from a local wholesaler.
We can provide a year's worth of fresh fruits and vegetables to a household at only $1,000 per year it costs for us.
Like Dawson's program, Rush Medical Center food distributions are also funded primarily by donations. It operates a food pantry for patients in need. Food is Medicine Program Director Julia Bassett says individuals are referred to the pantry by a physician based on their level of food insecurity.
It's gotten a bit worse, honestly. You have, again, communities that are under-resourced. They don't have grocery stores. We do food distributions, and that helps support, but again, a Band-Aid approach.
Bassett says the program gets around 70 physician referrals per week. With free, fresh food sourced from the Greater Chicago Food Depository, she says the program aims to alleviate comorbidity issues. But even with distributions in place, Bassett says more food is needed.
If we had those things in place, we could really change the trajectory of some of our Black and brown people who are experiencing some of those issues.
Bassett says money is the key to addressing food insecurity.
Continue to fund these very emergent needs of communities. If we still have that type of support until we can get a good grocer or some sort of co-op in the communities, that will really help kind of sustain some of the programs that we have currently.
No matter the obstacle, local organizations are still focused on supporting their own.
We're all in community together, and we all need a helping hand.
For WTTW News and Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism, I'm Mila Branson.
Again, that was a WTTW News partnership with Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. You can find more details on our website. And that's our show for this Monday night. For more on what our newsroom is working on, you can follow us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. And you can stay connected with us on Blue Sky. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. We break down the city's new budget and much more with our Spotlight Politics team. And last week, President Biden pardoned nearly 1,500 people for their criminal convictions. Hundreds of men and women in Illinois are asking Governor Pritzker to do the same. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, wishing all a happy and healthy holiday season.